And now, ladies and gentlemen,
check it out.
You've Got to Start Somewhere, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of show business to prove there's no such thing as an overnight success. With your host, Rachel Corbett.
Thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to the show. Today I'm very excited about the guest because he is a bit of a slashy. He's done all sorts of things: comedian, actor, writer, radio and TV presenter, producer, director, and one of the hosts of the project. It is the lovely Peter Hellier.
Thank you, Rachel. I'm glad you didn't describe me as a slushy. I thought that may have been coming as well. It's part of my dark past. But thank you for having me on. Am I the first person to be on this show who can claim to be a fan of the show?
Yes, you are.
Because, yeah, it's early days, and I'm sure those who have been were guests early, the show wasn't out yet.
True, yeah.
So, but I have been listening, and congratulations, it's a great podcast.
I appreciate your support, because often when I do the project, you'll give me a little, oh, I heard this, or I heard that, or I heard this, and you know.
I've started fangirling around you a little bit, to be honest.
But I like it, because you know, when you're making things, you would know you've made a million things, you often think, is anybody going to care? Anybody going to be interested?
I think it's really important, though, to reach out to the people. And I'm in a privileged situation where often I can reach out to people and say, you know, congratulations on doing this. And I'm getting them and making this podcast or in that first episode of, you know, whatever show it might be or the radio, getting a radio gig or whatever. So I do try to, certainly not in a fake way, I try to make sure I've...
I felt it was a little fake, but...
The first couple of weeks, and I actually listened to it, I thought, actually, it's actually pretty good. So I started citing examples and...
Yeah, the first couple of weeks you were like, you were just saying the name that was on the title description and then you got a bit deeper into the detail.
I was reading it off my iPhone. Yeah. It was cleverly hidden under the table.
Really enjoyed episode one, Whipper. Loved that one. But you've gotten a bit better on the details. Actually, that's an interesting point because you're right. You are at that point now where you are, you know, one of the more well-known people in Australian media. So you can put a call in or a text in or a tweet into somebody and say, really love that. And it would actually mean a lot to people. I certainly feel, you know, chuffed that you like the show. But you are in a position where you could, if you heard somebody's podcast and they were just starting out and they got a tweet or something from Peter Hellier, that would mean a huge amount. There's a weight in your sort of...
I mean, it's hard for me to have perspective on that. But I do, you know, I mean, I have been doing this for long enough to know that it might be a nice thing to hear or to read. And I certainly know and have been thankful for the people who were good to me in my early days of stand-up comedy and television. And when people said nice things, I remember reading that Sean McAuliffe, you know, thought I was funny. That was in print and I'd never met him. And I was like, oh, my God, Sean McAuliffe said that. You know, and so it's, it is lovely. So I've tried to kind of, you know, keep that in mind. But, I mean, look, it's not a strategy. It's just something that I think it's just part of my nature. I like being part of a good industry, and I want it to be good and better. And so when I see something I really like, I want to encourage people to keep doing that.
Let me just semi-begin, because we've already done a bit of yapping, but what is your full name?
Peter Jason Matthew Hellier.
Why in your Wikipedia page does it say Peter Nice Gary Hellier?
I don't know. I've not been on my Wikipedia page for quite a few years, so I have no idea what's in there. I know there used to be the photo they use. Is it still the Strawny in the Celebrity Grand Prix? Yes. I've got a feeling. I think the reason, I mean, I'm not sure how many people, why you would be on your own Wikipedia page anyway, but I've got a feeling the people or the person who runs my Wikipedia page, and obviously lots of people can jump in. I remember years ago thinking, I'm not sure if they're the biggest fans of mine because I feel like most of the things I've done have worked. I've been very lucky, but it really made it seem like all the things I'd done had failed miserably.
Right.
Which, you know, eventually a show like Rove Live did come to an end, but it came to an end after 10 years. before the game came to an end after 12 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I haven't been back on the Wikipedia page, but I'm glad they're nice, Gary. I'm not even sure. Usually sometimes that can be a reference to something you've put out there.
I love Wikipedia pages and just having a quick perusal when I do this show, because the number of bullshit entries that just, you're like, where are people getting this information? And you're right. As a person in the media, you don't tend to go on your Wikipedia page. So you've got no idea what is on there. And for most people, that is their sole source of information about individuals and topics and that kind of stuff. And then you go on, you're like, this is what people have been thinking about me the whole time, that my middle name is Nice Gary? Like, how do you even come up with that? So when did you first start doing comedy? When was your first sort of foray into it?
Well, my first gig was October 27th, 1996. I booked into the ESPY at St Kilda, which was a famous kind of room, which sadly doesn't run anymore, the Gershwin Room. It's a beautiful room, and you used to basically, every Melbourne comedian and any Australian comedian who would want to start in Melbourne would book, and you'd speak to a guy called Trevor. Trevor's a great guy, a bit of a stoner, and he would book you in, and he would ask two questions. Have you got 5 minutes, and do you know how to hold a microphone? And I was confident I had 5 minutes, and I was pretty sure I could hold a mic, so I said, yep, no worries at all. And you get put into this lineup, and they have like an MC, and usually somebody well-known closes the show, but it goes like the entire Sunday afternoon. It's like a marathon. And the night before, I didn't tell anyone. I was like, no, I'm going to do this on my own. I don't want, you know, a false economy. I want to go down and just see how good I am, you know. And night before, I went to my mate's 21st, Scotty Laugh-A-Leaders, in the backyard in Bundoora. And I was doing the speech and nailed the speech, just like nailed the speech.
Yeah.
And had a few beers and just told everyone, I'm starting my stand-up comedy career tomorrow. And everyone's like, well, we've got to come down and see it.
You had a little taste of the applause and you were like, I want more of this.
I want more of this. So, about 10 mates came down. But it's always got good crowds. So it was about 200 people there.
And you were 21 at the time?
I was 21 and I remember walking, I had my 5 minutes. I remember walking to the microphone stand, and I wore a like a dinner suit, because I didn't know who I was yet, and I wanted to separate myself on stage to what I, you know, just a casual clothes, hoodie kind of wearing.
Right. Kid. So it wasn't like the first day on the job thing where, you know, the people that turn up for their first day on the job at McDonald's and they rock up in a suit and then they were, I've overdressed. It wasn't that. It was that you had actually wanted to set yourself apart.
I was setting myself apart. I didn't go in a microfiber suit, you know, with a Davenport novelty tie, with a briefcase with the Herald Sun and the banana in it. No, it was more about the, you know, and I didn't even know what my voice was going to be like when I, you know, I didn't know how the words were going to come out. I think a lot of comedians early on, they're more joke-based than they are routine-based. So I had a lot of jokes.
But had you practiced those?
I had practiced, and every time it was a little bit different, and I knew it. I'd really prepared.
Mm.
But the one thing I wasn't sure about was which routine to start with. And I walked to the microphone stand. I've actually got my first gig on VHS. I know Lawrence was saying he has two.
Oh, that's cool.
It's actually my latest tour, which I recorded for Channel 10, called One Hot Mess. On the DVD, we're going to put the first gig on that as a bonus feature. And I mean, I remember watching it back, and I thought I got to the mic stand and like tried to really rip the microphone out of the stand, like, but I couldn't get it out.
Mm.
And I thought I was really like tugging at it. And I when I watched it back, I realized it was the most placid little, like, I was almost scared of the mic and everything. Oh, shit, maybe I don't know how to hold a microphone. So I stood at the microphone stand, never took it out of the stand. And I still had this bottle of water that I just had in my hand that I forgot to put down.
Don't know what to do with your hands.
No,
when
I don't
you're
know what to do with my
out.
Hand. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Ricky Bobby. Yep. And my choices were between this fish and chip shop joke that I had and this joke about phone sex. And I remember getting to the microphone stand, still not knowing, and just, I'm not sure, I can't remember deciding, but the fish and chip joke kind of came out first. And it was great. Like, it worked beautifully. And I'll tell you the joke.
Yeah.
It's a joke that works really well in Melbourne and Adelaide and Perth and Tasmania, but not in Sydney and Queensland. The joke is I've had a bad start to the week. I walked into a fish and chip shop and accidentally ordered maximum chips.
Oh, okay.
So this is the thing. In Melbourne, you order minimum chips. So yeah. If you order maximum chips, Rachel, there's going to be a lot of chips. So there's a couple of lines after that about the amount of chips, and two drunk fat guys dressed as seagulls came to the house looking for the chips. So there's a couple of little after lines. But it worked, and I was away.
Yeah.
And I made the right choice. The rest of the gig went really well. I had a great gig. And just on that, with that fish and chip joke, about a year into my stand-up career, I got to go to Sydney on this tour. And did the Harold Park Hotel, the famous, legendary Harold Park Hotel. And I'd seen American Rosso perform there. So I was like, oh, this is going to be great. This is going to be awesome. And I've got my opener, Fish and Chips. And, I walked out, did that as my opener, and learned the lesson. Just do some research about local areas, about terminology, vernacular, and it died. I got back on track. But it was a good lesson to learn, and so the first gig, did the second gig about a month later, was great. It went even better. Then the third gig was horrible.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I started doing new material, and that wasn't really kind of not as baked as the other stuff. And I was talking to the audience a bit of, hey, where are you from? And they would say Croydon, and I was like, I got nothing about Croydon. What do you do? I work in IT. Oh, got nothing on. Got nothing there. And it was just awful. And my sister had brought her new boyfriend that I hadn't met yet, and who she's now married to. It was just so excruciating. And I remember going down to, it was at the SB again, and I went down to St Kilda Beach and just got, there's a bottle shop at the SB, and I got, and I don't know why, this is, you're not in your right head. I was like heartbroken. It's like, what happened? What just happened? Why wasn't this gig like the other gigs? And maybe I can't do this for this. Maybe the dream is dead. So I got a six pack of UDLs. I don't know why I got UDLs. I don't know why they were UDLs.
I thought you were going to say the only other option in my head I had was that you bought a 500ml bottle of Maduri and just skull
and just had illusion shakers on the beach. No, I got UDLs, and I started drinking UDLs. I mean, my sister just like rubbing my back, and her new boyfriend, who I hadn't met, just being kind of awkward and just going, oh, I thought it was pretty good.
Good Lord. Do you think it was because you had an inflated sense of confidence because of those early
gigs? I reckon it was a part of me that kind of thought, good, I can do this.
Yeah,
I can
right.
do this. And not realizing that every gig is different.
Mm.
And and a new material needs, to be really worked, and you can't go out with an idea that's like a premise. I was probably going out with premises on that third gig, not
and a
actual
huge
jokes
lack
or punch
of geographical
lines.
Knowledge.
Yeah, exactly, and also not having the artillery to kind of sometimes I'll start gigs with new material now because I'm just well, I know I can get it back on track.
Mm.
No gig's going to break me now. No gigs make or break. Mm. I did a gig in Fairfield last night of the room that Dave O'Neill runs, and I was committed to doing 90% new material, and I knew I just had a joke that I opened my last tour with and a routine at the end from about two shows ago that I thought if it goes a bit off track that I've just got a routine that is safe and I know it's funny, the audience is going to love it. And and there was some highs and lows in the new material, and okay well that works, and okay that needs some work. But you don't go out kind of going, oh my God, if I don't laugh at this, I'm going to... And that's what you earn, by doing...
Well, you've got a decent body of work now, and you've accomplished a lot, so it's not like you're going out there thinking, am I any good? You know you're capable of this.
Well, absolutely. And when I go to do stand-up now, I've got family, I've got three boys, and I'm like, well, I can't just go and do these gigs just to feel like a rock star comedian all the time, because I can go and do a gig. I could have done that gig last night and done... really well-worn kind of material that I know inside out, and I know where all the laughs are, and had the best night and felt like, right now I'm the greatest comedian in the world. But if I'm going to leave my wife with the kids and go out at night and after I've already been at work all day, there needs to be something more. There needs to be something that helps the progression of my stand-up comedy career, which is always building towards the next show.
Do you feel, I was watching that documentary about Jerry Seinfeld, comedian, where him and Orny Adams,
yeah.
And that sense that when Orny Adams used to get so angry because Jerry Seinfeld would walk into the room and get applause just for standing there just because he was Jerry Seinfeld. Do you feel when you're doing new material, because there's a lot of people that love what you've done and you have like a soft spot in their heart already, do you feel like it's still hard work to get the audience on side for some of that new material? Are they still happy to tell you when they don't like it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And there's a great thing, that quote by Colin Quinn in that documentary where he says, even if you're famous, like if you take Jack Nicholson, the most revered man in Hollywood, if he was to walk out on stage, there'd be like a grace period of, you might have said like 7 minutes, or maybe not even that, maybe it was 3 minutes, where he'd be like laughing at everything, anything he said. And then after that, he'd be like, okay, you've been on stage for a few minutes now, Jack, we need some laughs.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
There is a bit of that. And I mean, last night I did a routine about feminism and I wasn't sure how it was going to go. There's certainly something in that in there, but it's not ready yet, you know. But the only way you get it ready is by doing it on stage.
Mm.
And this is where it's really, people often say, being a comedian must be really tough. And it's not. It's great. But the tough bit of it is that moment. Like that when you are driving to a gig. I mean, the fun stuff is when you get to play 1,000 people,
mm-hmm.
you know, at a comedy festival, you know, or 2,500 people at the Enmore Theatre. Like, that's where it's glorious. That's where it's just fun. But you earn that because you've driven to a crowd of 60 people, sometimes less than that, to do material that you're not completely sure about yet.
Mm.
And knowing there'll be people in that audience who'll see that and walk away going, oh, Pete Alley wasn't as funny as I thought he was.
Yeah, does that, you know, how does that play on your mind?
Well, you just have to, you know, make sure that the other stuff, there is some good stuff. So you can't, and I'm always aware that people have paid money to come see a show, so I can't be completely indulgent and make it all about, unless it's a new material type of night.
Mm.
Always, that's why I had that routine at the end, which I thought was going to be, you know, is safe as houses. And I knew that if I had one or two things that didn't work, the new material, I would have probably maybe gone, okay, let's just steady up here with some, you know. And that's where you have this artillery. You have this artillery of 21 years of doing stand-up comedy where you can call on stuff on stage. And that's why you don't feel the panic as much as somebody who's on their third gig and doesn't know where Croydon is.
When did you first realise, I think I am funny?
At school, the teachers used to allow me to... There's a humanities teacher who allowed me to host the class when they did like oral presentations.
Oh, yeah.
So this is the day of Tonight Live with Steve Izard.
Yep.
And I love that so much. She would sit in my seat and I'd sit at the desk and she would let me kind of give the introductions to people. I used to do like little school plays that I would do off my own steam. There's no reason for me to do them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I just loved getting laughs. And I loved watching television. And I, you know, I used to believe that I was watching television with a purpose. Like I was trying to kind of dissect.
Research.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I actually said that to my dad. He goes, you know, you're wasting your time watching so much television. I said, well, maybe I might work in television one day. Maybe I'm working at what I like and what I don't like.
How old were you? That is. That's a pretty interesting kind of insight to have.
I was about 13 or 14 when I said this, I was saying that. And, yeah, I remember in politics in year 11. I was studying politics and a teacher, Roscoe, he... He had a rule, and his rule was you can make a joke, and this is for the whole class, you can make a joke at any point in my class as long as it's funny.
Oh,
if it's funny, you stay. If it's not funny, you're out.
Oh, I'm liking
this. And Roscoe. I loved it. I was like, this is amazing. This is like built for me. I'm just, you know, and it kind of, Jerry Seinfeld says he wasn't the class clown, he was a class comedian. And this was a way of splitting the class comedians from the class clowns, because the class clowns would try to be funny and they're like, no, you haven't got the skills, you haven't got the craft. You know, but the class comedians, I wasn't the only one. We did, and we were able to, you know, get jokes away and stay in the class.
I feel like being, you know, having that ability to sort of make people laugh, especially in school, is such a protector in that environment where you're trying to work out who the hell am I? How do I make friends? How do I get into these groups that make sure I've got enough of a like social fabric here that I feel okay?
Yeah.
It's such a skill to get through those early years.
And it's a defensive mechanism. Yeah, this may shock you, Rachel, but I was a bit of a chubby kid.
No,
seriously. No. Seriously, I know. And, you know, so at the time, I probably wasn't thinking like this, but I think I look back at it now and I go, it probably was partly a defense mechanism. Get on the front foot, do the jokes yourself before they do the jokes. And as a result, I've never kind of received any kind of name calling, really. Mm. I mean, I was, you know, I was lucky enough to have a really great group of friends going through primary school and then into high school and got along with most of the kids in the year level.
Yeah. The only really bad taunt I remember was at the year eight dance when Simon yelled across the dance floor, "Rachel Corbett's frigid." And it hurt so much because it was true.
How things have changed.
I realised I'd been found out. I thought that I had like put up the, you know, veneer of this very confident young woman. I wasn't fooling anybody.
That was pre-television radio, Rachel Corbett. Of course, things have changed.
They have changed.
But I remember being really relieved when I got through school that nobody picked up that you could quite easily rhyme hellier with smellier. I was like, how did nobody see
Never.
That? I kind of kept that under my belt. How could nobody pick that up?
You've literally gotten to the end of school puffing and panting in relief, like, oh, I made it.
I was at the gate, at the exit gate, this year 12, this guy, smellier, you never saw it. You never saw it, yours.
So when you were researching on your watching TV, you know, while you were saying, I might work in TV one day, had you gotten that dream somehow ingrained in you? Were you thinking that's what I wanted to do? What did you want to do between leaving school and getting on stage at 21?
No, I think by the time I was leaving school, I was committed to being... Actually, I wanted to make films and I thought if I do stand-up comedy, which I had fallen in love with through watching a big gig and having footy club comedy nights and you know, seeing Trevor Marmalade and, mm-hmm. and just going, oh, that looks amazing. And I saw Greg Fleet, the comedy club, when I was 15 and just going, oh, my God, I think this is what I want to do. So I just kind of kept the journal from about 15 to 21 or so. And this of jokes and this ideas. And earlier, I wanted to be a zookeeper. That was my first thing I really wanted to do. And then I realised I didn't particularly like handling animals.
Important.
So, yeah, hands-off zookeepers aren't really in demand. So, and then I thought about acting, but that was the stage where the first sentence you heard shooting back at you when you even whispered that you wanted perhaps become an actor was, 99% of actors are out of work. I think now it's 97. but thank you, Netflix. But it's... and that was a stage where... And Australians, it was only the local industry. There was no going over and being a famous actor in America. That was a stupid idea. And it really was Mel Gibson and Nicole Kidman and Paul Hogan who kind of started... You know, I remember being genuinely excited by their success and seeing Paul Hogan host the Academy Awards and going, oh, my God. I remember seeing Crocodile Dundee in the cinema, you know, a couple of times and just being, oh, my God. You know, I kind of grew up in this really lovely time where Australian cinema had, like, The Man from Snowy River and Crocodile Dundee's, you know, our own stories in our own cinemas and this explosion of music from grade 5 to grade 6. I think the albums Kick, Diesel and Dust, Man of Colours by Ice House, Crowded House's debut album and Who Degrees Blow Your Cool all came out. So, like, and Paul Kelly was around. Yeah. So, I really grew up with a really deep love of Australian entertainment. Mm. So, despite that, I kind of just thought, oh, well, I can't be an actor because there's no future in it. But then, you know, I started seeing comedy and thinking, well, let's just give it a go. And I just didn't really have anything else that I wanted to do. I thought of journalism for a little bit. But
did you go to uni?
I applied for two courses, I think, Melbourne Law.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a joke because I had no chance of getting into Melbourne Law. And the other one was a professional writing course at RMIT, which I got knocked back from. Ironically, a year ago, I was invited to go speak to the students of professional writing at RMIT, which was lovely. And the first thing I mentioned was they were already in front of me at that stage because I was knocked back from this very course.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Good lesson, though. I think at that age you think it's the end of the world.
Yeah.
But a good lesson in the fact that there is always a way around. If you are built for it and if you are a creative person that wants to make stuff, you will get there eventually.
I've still got rejection letters from neighbours, as far as for writing for neighbours.
Oh, really?
For Triple R, we were looking for something. And I think Kate Lambrook's even, when Kate Lambrook was working on that show, I got a rejection letter from them. I think one thing that was good, Film Victoria ran a screenwriter scheme, a new screenwriter scheme. And I wrote a script when I was about 17. But it was a really dark, nothing comedic about it.
Yeah.
It was about a guy who found he wanted to be like a famous director, and he couldn't find what he wanted to make, and he found this heroin addict OD'd in the bathroom, and decided to follow her around with a camera. So this is kind of
this is actually kind of a cool idea.
Yeah, and this was like 1992, so this is like pre a lot of these really big reality shows.
Mm.
And then his friend is like the cameraman. And it becomes like kind of like this triangle, because the director's kind of like pushing this girl but towards her demise, and the cameraman's kind of falling in love with this girl. And yeah, and they kind of met with me, and you know, and they said, listen, we love it. Would you consider not making it as dark as it is?
Mm.
And I was like, no, it is what it is. And, you know, hell yeah, don't budge. And then
I understand you guys have been doing this for a while, but I don't know if you know. I'm 17. I've had quite a bit of life experience.
I know what I'm doing. So they wished me all the best and said if there's anything we can do to, you know, help support you. And but it was really great because, you know, I was 17 and they met with me. You know, I went and had a coffee in the city with them, and that was amazing. And you just if you can get these little guides that you're on the right track. I remember writing, you know, that book that I ended up losing in a taxi, by the way. Yeah, with the years of, like, you know, jokes, which I always believe is like a golden little joke book, like it's in the suitcase in Pulp Fiction, but if you open it, it's glow of gold, but it's probably full of shit, to be honest, let's face it. But I remember writing a couple of jokes that Jim Owen ended up doing, like, just as a coincidence. Mm. Like, and I remember a mate who I would often tell these jokes to, he said, you must be, are you disappointed? I go, no, this is great. I'm on the right path. This is Jim Owen.
Jim
Owen's the hottest comedian, you know, at least one of the hottest comedians in the country, you know. And if I'm somehow like, you know, we're thinking, you know, for a couple of seconds the same way, then maybe, maybe I'm on the right track.
You could do it. Well, was it all a bunch of sort of incremental steps towards the stand-up and then to where you are, or did you sort of veer off the path and work doing something else for a while? And
yes, I was working at Dan Murphy Sellers, the bottle shop.
You're just smashing back UDL cans in the back.
I swear I didn't knock off any UDLs. They were so good to me because the manager at the time, Pete Johns, he was in a band called Desert Mouth.
Oh, hello. Yeah.
And they used to play the SB a bit as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had a bit of simpatico, is that the term?
Yeah.
For what I was doing as well. So he would know that I'd be in the back storeroom, not packing boxes, that I was, you know, writing comedy routines and that stuff. And, you know, I used to be the kind of guy who would go for like a 2-hour shit to avoid work. Yeah. My legs just, you know, getting lactic acid build up and just numb. Imagine people like, Hallie, are you in there? How long is this shit going for?
So was that the only sort of normal job you had before you started doing the telly stuff?
I did a radio course. There's a program called LEAP. Mm. I forget what it stands for, but I went overseas chasing a girl, and then this is a random girl. I had a Finnish girlfriend who went back to Finland because she's an exchange student. So I went after her and spent about 6 months overseas. Then came back, and there was this thing where you could sign up, the government would pay you basically to do a radio course for, I was going to say 6 weeks, but it felt more like 6 months, to be honest.
Can you imagine that passing in the budget these days?
Oh, no. It's funny, isn't it?
Wow.
Yeah. And I was between that and doing Channel 31,
yeah,
which, you know, basically no longer exists thanks to the cuts to the arts. It's I've been very lucky to come through when I did. And I did that, and I met some great people, and that's where I met Merrick. Merrick was the first person I met because my co-host, we started doing a show on the Friday Morning Magazine. Mm. And we didn't name the show. It was like Monday Morning Magazine, Tuesday Morning Magazine, Wednesday. And we did the Friday shift.
Right, yep.
And my co-host, James Brasher, who is possibly the funniest man I know outside of comedy, we used to do a show together, and he went to school with Merrick, and he brought Merrick in for an interview. He goes, I can get Merrick to come in for an interview. And that's when I met Merrick.
So how old were you then?
I would have been 19.
Wow.
And Merrick was doing a gig down the Armadale, and I went down and saw him then. I remember him wearing checkered pants and making jokes about redheads in the army. And I said, I like this guy.
Classic Mez.
Yeah, classic Mez. And then they were the first people who took me under their wing, like Merrick and Ross. I was just blown away by what they were doing. They were doing these shows there were rock shows, you know, and then off their own steam, they were kind of a little bit outside the industry. It used to be like me and like Fleety kind of were the only comedians, you know, kind of that I really remember kind of frequently being there. And then eventually they would, I was supporting them. And eventually I was on the poster, you know, for the Electric Boogaloo shows. And you know, and then they got me on Triple J doing this Peter Hellier PI where I would do these challenges and I'd, you know, doing Bevan the Musical and which got weirdly got to number 35 in the Triple J Hottest 100 that year. Wow. So it was kind of this really weird kind of thing. But they were like the first, even before I met Rove, you know, they were the first people who really took me under their wing and I'd help them shoot videos for their shows and do anything they asked. I was like, yep, I am whatever, because I want to be a part of this. And I love that people watch those guys and they just wanted to have a beer with those guys after the show. And that's, I think that's what's really special, you know, if you can get that. Not every comedian feels like that, you know, but I feel like I'm a pub comic, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a pub comic who gets to play theatres. Yeah, I thought it was it's such a special thing. And I remember the best advice, if you know, you may be going to ask me that later, but I'll save it for later. But Rosso gave me some great advice.
No, you tell me now.
Okay,
yeah.
The advice he gave me was, he said, comedy's about ideas. And it's so true.
Mm.
And that's what I try to tell everyone. Have ideas for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Have ideas for podcasts. Have ideas for movies, for TV shows, all kinds of TV shows, all kinds of movies. Have ideas for jokes, you know, for a web series, you know, let's, anything.
Mm.
For articles, columns. You know, there's so much media now. I cannot believe when I talk to people and they're like, I just don't have any ideas.
Yeah, I know. So
don't do this anymore.
Yeah, totally.
Because, like, my biggest fear is not realizing half the ideas that
totally.
I have.
Totally.
And sometimes I get into the trap of not being able to choose which one to kind of really kind of go full throttle for next.
I also get fearful that some of them are going to be done in the time that it takes me to get them done. And especially the ones I'm super passionate about. I think if I see this pop up somewhere, I am going to kick myself.
I have a film idea. And funnily enough, I was hoping to, I was thinking yesterday, I should actually meet with the people like this week. I was going to actually see if I can see them tomorrow. Because I'm like, this has been in my head for years now.
Yeah.
And somebody's going to do it. And it's, the thing I learned about the movie that I did is that you really need a really strong hook. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been asked a lot why I haven't done another movie after I Love You Too. And the reason is the landscape is a tricky one.
Mm.
It's a really tricky one. And I Love You Too did quite well, but it probably lacked that real hook that you need to kind of go, oh, I need to see that. And our thing was probably that it was a romantic comedy and we don't make many romantic comedies, but that's probably not strong enough really to, especially when we went to the American market and we got a great reaction, but it was like, we have Jennifer Aniston and Cameron Diaz and, you know, Katherine Heigl at the time doing these comedies, you know. No offense to Brennan Cowell and Yvonne Strahovski, and we had Peter Dinklage pre-Game of Thrones. But the one, I have this one idea and it's not a comedy, but it's like, whoever does it first, it's going
to
be great.
It has to be you.
Yeah, and it's going to be me because I've got the idea and I've got the twist on the idea. It's kind of half built on something like an urban legend.
You have to have this meeting this week.
Yeah, I know. I feel like it's out there, you know.
Now that you've said it, now I think sometimes it's like you have to mention it to somebody or say it or book. You need to be held accountable.
And I've started doing that. And I've written probably about 30 pages of a script and like a bit of a breakdown. And I've told a few people. And whoever I've told, and I'll tell you off air.
Mm-hmm.
People go, yeah, do that.
You must do that. I want to go back and talk about Merrick and Rosso and that relationship and the idea of having those long-standing friendships that have come through over the years. I think in this business sometimes, especially when certain people get to certain different levels of success, there is, I think, a sense because some people do think about relationships in an opportunistic way, and you'll notice when you meet somebody that thinks that they can get something from you, there is definitely that sense. So the higher you climb the ladder, the more that becomes a part of your analysis, I think, of different people that you meet. It's like, oh, do you want something from me? Because you have a lot more sort of cachet than they do, and that can come into play. But when you have friendships that started out when you were all nobody just throwing shit against a wall,
oh, yeah.
Those are the friendships that are so nice to have through your entire career, because you know they were based before you had any kind of profile.
Yeah.
And it's pretty rare to have those kind of long-lasting friendships from when you were 19 yeah. in this business, even before. So it's not like you met in media. You met sort of, you know, even before.
Plenty Valley FM is media. I mean, okay, come on. Right. Friday Morning Magazine.
Actually,
I mean, did you hear the McThomas interview?
Actually, I do remember you coming onto the show that Merrick and I and Jules Schiller used to do, and you and Mez did the sketch.
Reenactment. Yeah.
You did the reenactment of Plenty Valley FM, which I must see. I keep everything. I'm going to see if I can find that, and if I can, I'll insert a little bit into the podcast.
Do we do the reenactment of me being our political reporter at the election? Because I feel no. like... I've done that somewhere where maybe I did it on one of my own radio shows where, in fact, I think I did, because they sent me down to cover the election at the local Labor headquarters. And I, you know, even though I'd studied politics and I didn't really know much.
Man, I saw your coverage of the budget on the project the other night. Yeah. You got no idea.
Hey, I've come a long way, but maybe I've actually digressed. Having those relationships is, it's one of the really things I'm proud of and I love about this industry and this community even more than the industry, to see the guys and the girls that I kind of came through with. And I do believe, and sorry if anyone's listening to this who believes they didn't get to where they wanted to get to, but I believe those who came through in my generation, everyone who worked hard, was talented and worked hard, got, you know, their chances.
Yeah,
I really believe that. And sometimes it took longer. You know, Lawrence Mooney, he started around the same time as I did, and I might be wrong with the timeline, but his probably first break was like a Denise, and you know, mm-hmm. It was a nice gig for him. But you know, it's like only really the last few years where I think Lawrence has really become Lawrence Mooney that we just adore and love, and it's just been so great to see. That Tom Gleason probably took, you know, even though Tom was doing like Skid House and I did that with him and all of that, but again, the last few years I think it's really been Tom Gleason's just become, you know, that's, you are perfectly formed now.
Yeah and know. It takes time sometimes.
It does take time, and yeah. I sometimes feel that I perhaps was snatched a little bit too early. I mean, I did that gig in 96, so I did two gigs in 96, did a dozen to 20 in 97, probably did 40 in 98, and at the very start of 99 we did a Rove pilot. So,
but were you doing the Loft Live, Channel 31 during that time? So that was sort of the precursor to Rove. That was like Rove Light, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. And so Rove asked me at there's a room called Elbow Grease, which was an amazing room it was like our generation's room. It was a typical night on a Sunday night would be Will Anderson, me, Adam Richard. American Ross are doing a little bit of Triple J then, so they wouldn't be as regular as some of the others. Rove, mm-hmm. Michelle Laurie, Corinne Grant, Dave Callan, Husey, I mentioned Husey, but, you know, like just this awesome bunch of people coming through roughly at the same time. And everyone, you just wanted to be as good as you could be. It was beautifully competitive. You know, it was that if Princess Diana, when she died, we all knew that everyone was going to be doing Princess Diana gear.
Yeah, right.
So bring your best Princess Diana
gear. Yeah, that's cool.
You know, or even it was just about doing you, you know. And those were back in the days when, you know, social media's changed. I'm not sure if we'd get away with doing those kind of, the thirst for me to kind of go, okay, something bad has happened in the world. Let's get on stage and make some jokes about it. I mean, my take was always about the media, the night she passed away, I remember... the only thing I did, and I was like third on and nobody had mentioned it yet. This is the day she died. It's a Sunday night. And I just said, so has anyone seen the news today? Anything happen? You know, I've been out. I was at the footy. And it just kind of like that enough.
Let the air out of the room.
Just that, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember there was at a comedy club a few nights later when the funeral was, and that was a really tough... That was strange because that was felt like just nobody wanted to laugh about it on that night. So that was kind of...
I remember doing an improv comedy gig the day after, like the morning or the lunchtime of September 11 happening that evening.
Wow, yeah.
And it was just... It was just that weird kind of, how can we even be doing this? What are we even? It's weird when those big monumental events happen and people still want to laugh, people still want to go out, but there's such a sense of like, ugh, how do I deal with this ickiness?
This sounds kind of weird. We got lucky with that because we, on Rove, that was when it was on Tuesday night, and we got off air and we're in the green room and we watched it happen on TV in our green room.
Oh, wow.
And I say we got lucky only because we're a comedy show that was dealing in still, you know, a big news story of the day as far as a monologue goes. We had 1 week separation from that happening to being back on air and kind of going, okay, do we have to deal with it in the week's time? Are people ready to move on as far as, you know?
Gives you a bit of space to work out, okay, how are we going to approach this as opposed to being thrust into it at the time and thinking, oh, my goodness. It's almost impossible not to be insensitive when you haven't got the benefit of a bit of time to have a think about things.
That's why people judge things that happen live often, you know, even like the Oscars moment, you know, something as kind of seemingly as frivolous as that. It's like when it's live, none of us have the benefit of hindsight. You know, I'm amazed that I haven't had more kind of, you know, faux pas live.
Because it's tough because you're grabbing for things. You know, yes, you come into things prepared, but often in the moment you're thinking, I got to fill a space.
Yeah.
And sometimes you fill a space with something that you go, oh, goodness, that I shouldn't have filled it with that.
That you know, exactly the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's hard because you just want to get out of the break sometimes. So what you were doing, the gigs and the stand-up, did you meet Rove on that circuit and then he put together that Channel 31 show?
I met him at Elbow Grease. That's why I mentioned Elbow Grease actually before. So he tapped me on the shoulder after a gig and said that was great. And I'd seen him on stage before. And we just went to another room and just started having a couple of beers. And then we became really close mates really quickly. Like we had, I think, similar kind of backgrounds. And we just liked each other a lot. And after a little while, he said to me, listen, I've got this Channel 31 show. Do you want to come on and you can do whatever you like? And I had this idea for these little kind of mockumentary sketches called, I'm not sure if I had the name then, but it became Other People's Lives. And it was, actually, I'd shot one with my friend James Brash at the radio station just as for fun. And we shot this about this guy called Damien Wishbank who nobody rocked up to his 21st. And he's just at his 21st and he's like, his parents didn't go because they had another 21st to go to. And James is the DJ who ended up doing the speech, we just shot it at the radio station. And then I said, well, I wouldn't mind doing more of those, to be honest. We can even show that one if you like.
Yeah.
You know? And we shot a couple. We shot one about the guy who deliberately went out, shot Australia's Funniest Home Videos, choreographed these accidents. Usually it'd be Adam Richard and Kim Hope would help me out and Rove, and they would kind of play characters as well. And there was one where, we had nobody. It was just me. So it ended up being me as a journalist interviewing this Irish guy, which is me in wearing glasses and a Guinness beanie, about my long-lost twin brother who'd gone missing. It was so kind of great. And this is actually, funnily enough, I had a kind of feeling when we did the budget shoot, because we go into the budget, the federal budget, where we get locked in and we have a rough idea of what we want. But because we're at the mercy of who wants the cameo and who doesn't and what, you know, Scott Morrison will be prepared to do with us, we don't know. And it kind of felt like we're just grabbing stuff as we go along. And it kind of gave me that little feeling that I haven't, I don't get to do that kind of shooting much anymore. Mm. So it was kind of fun. And that was the stuff with American Ross. I just running around the streets, just filming stuff. In my first year first full year of comedy, 1997, with James Brashard, who I've called the funniest guy outside of comedy, he kind of came into comedy for a little bit. I dragged him in and we had this thing called Crash and Burn. And we would go at Elbow Grease at the start of the night and say, give us a genre, give us a line and give us a prop, and we will go away, make a movie, and come back at the end of the night and show the movie on the screen.
Wow.
And
how long would you have? What would be the end of the night?
Like 2 hours.
Wow.
So we'd have to edit in camera, so you just and it would be rough, but it would be like, people loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it. We did 6 or 7 of them in the end.
If you can deliver when you're doing that kind of improvised last minute, we've had no planning, and you actually deliver something that's even, you know, semi good, there is such a payoff, because yeah. you've got the additional kind of high wire act of, you guys know none of this existed 2 hours ago.
Yeah.
So if you have the skills to actually put something together that can look like a fully formed story,
yeah,
man, an audience goes wild for that stuff.
Absolutely. They're invested because they help build it, you know, and it's something that's not going to exist outside of this night ever. Like, we can't show it on another night with getting that same reaction.
Yeah.
So here's something we shot that doesn't really make sense anymore. So, we did about 6 or 7 of them, and that was
I think
great.
That's probably, you know, there's a lot of people that sometimes say, oh, you were just in the right place at the right time, or it just so happened that you kind of managed to run into Rove and that ended up. But when you think about, you still have to be the person that comes to the table with, here is 19 ideas, here is an already existing segment, here is something, you know, that has to be that person that can actually come up with an idea and deliver on that idea, to be the person that is in the room at the same time, but that actually goes somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
So for Rove, I'm sure if he could have tapped somebody else on the shoulder and said, do you want to come in and do stuff? And they would have said, oh, yeah, what do you want me to do?
I have no doubt that the fact that I've been able to generate ideas has been a big part of my longevity and survival, even though, you know, hopefully around for many more years. But, you know, I mean, I can look at the Rove early years, and these segments might not mean anything, but we did a segment called From the Vault, which is my idea. Mm-hmm. Cliche Test was my idea. A lot of the long, we did a segment where about beard discrimination. It went for like 9 minutes. You know, that was my idea, and I wrote that. You know, we all got killed off in the final episode. That was my, you know, like,
yeah.
And then, you know, Peter Hellier PI was, you know, my idea, and we did a segment called Shovel Your Own Shit, where I'd interview other comedians in my shows and just like throw stuff at them. It's just an improv game, you know. And that was an idea that I had when I was doing a show called Shame with Michelle Laurie and Adam Richard and Kim Hope. Kim Hope and Adam Richard. Michelle Laurie was Shiny. Mm. And even with, you know, Project, I'm always bringing the segment ideas, Orky Talkies, and we did one last night called Witness of the Week.
Great,
you know, and it's stupid ideas, but like, they're ideas, you know. And then that extends to bigger ideas for movies and TV shows. It's a Date was an idea that just, you know, came out of me just loving watching people talk on screen.
Mm.
So ideas are, you know, absolute key.
Has it taken you a while to realise the value of that? Because I think when you do that quite naturally, because it's an easy skill, not an easy skill, but something that you kind of can't turn off, it's easy to undervalue what that is, because you think everybody can do this. And then I think it takes sometimes people a long time to realise, oh, this doesn't come naturally for everybody. Oh, this is valuable.
Something really happened. I went to this like kind of like leadership camp when I was like 12 or 13.
Mm.
And we're all sitting in a circle. And they told this story. And it was like, okay, there's a guy and a girl. And they're this and they're that and they're that. Everybody gives some ideas. And everyone gave their ideas. And they were a bit like, oh, yeah, maybe they've got a dog. And maybe it's in France. And it got to me, and I said, well, it's quite obvious to me that they're blind. But that was like, everyone just went,
yeah.
Because this kind of opened up this kind of like
world of possibilities.
World of possibilities. Mm. It became more interesting.
Mm. Even your idea of following around a heroin addict or whatever, like even that as a simple concept is a very, you can see the story in that is more complex than most people would come up with, you know? And I think when somebody who has good ideas sort of tells you their ideas, it becomes very obvious the difference between somebody who can come up with something that really would work and somebody that can't.
Well, often people will say to me, I want to do a movie about surfing. I've got this idea about a movie about surfing. What's the idea? It's about surfing.
Yeah.
Well, that's not the idea.
Yeah.
That's just the world that the idea may live in.
That's it.
If you want to make a surf movie, great, but you need who are the characters? Mm. Who's the protagonist? Who, you know, where are the obstacles? What's the intention? You know, like, so, I think I am very good in a room, and I love the early stages of a project where anything is possible, and you're like, what can we do? What can we do? And I love that.
Mm. When you were doing the Loft Live and that move to Rove Live, what was that process of that jump? How long had you been doing the Loft Live for?
Not that long. Like, I reckon I probably only did maybe 8 episodes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so had somebody seen that on
So the story 31? With Rove was Rob Brearley, who works here,
mm-hmm.
saw that and said, basically was like, saw Rove. That's who they're, you know, really interested in. Mm. Absolutely fair enough. And they said, that's, you know, let's chat to that guy. So Rob spoke to Craig Campbell, who's still the executive producer, yeah, you know, here at the project. And let's get Rove in. And then I remember being out at a night and it was like me. And I got to say, the early years are the best.
Mm.
Like when I was doing stand-up comedy and I was like the younger one in the group, like the new one coming through.
Yeah.
I was almost like Indiana Jones with the hat. Like just like I just got through before that generation kind of closed off and became the next generation. Michelle Laurie in her book called me like the puppy that everybody wanted to play with. And I remember like being in this room and it was the Miss Itchy girls, Linda Hagar and Faye Younger, who were like just the hottest property then and hilarious and still are hilarious. Will Anderson and somebody else and Rove.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. Every time I went to the bar or went to the bathroom, somebody would come up to me and say, just so you know, I've got a project going on at the ABC and it'd be great to have you on, you know, writing or, you know, we can discuss what you want to do, but it'd be great to have you on. Everyone except Rove. And they all kind of, you know, and it was all great. I was just like, this is amazing. Mm. You know, this is, I'm like 18 months into this thing and this is so good. And then I gave Rove a lift home.
Mm.
And we drove home and he said, he goes, listen, I kind of overheard a few people saying that they may have projects in the pipeline. Just promise me you won't sign anything. Because there's something, I've also got something and it might be something that you might be really interested in and we would really love to have you, you know, involved. And a few weeks after that, I got a call from my manager, which I still hear his voice, my manager, Kevin, who said, I think this is the phone call you've been waiting for.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I want Tesla. And yeah, and so we got invited to do the Rove pilot and it was amazing. Like to go to Channel 9, we were on like 11 o'clock, so we didn't feel any pressure. We were like kids at Disneyland and it was set up like old Hollywood. Like you had like the cabins, you know, outside the studios and I would write something and then people would go and make it. And it was like, this is amazing. And like, so the ideas got more elaborate. Like I wrote this one sketch called Would I Lie to You? And it was about this German game show. So we all had to learn German. Corinne learned it like that. If you watch it, my German, it's like, it's faux German, you know, it's not real German. It's just obvious. And it's like, we're in a paddock and the show was about a wife who suspected her husband was cheating. So the husband was in this chair played by Dave Callan and she asked him like three questions about whether he was cheating and if he lied. I was the host's. So I was like, and that's no lie. And like doing this weird kind of English-German thing with a megaphone. And eventually Dave lied. They had a lie detector strapped to him. And he lied three times and he just exploded.
Oh, wow. You know?
And like,
you just wanted to make use of the special effects department.
Explosions. I kept on writing like foreign language kind of sketches. And they said, can we have a few in English? Now, like there's one in Finnish that we did and
what was the, did they do just one pilot episode but it was recorded? It wasn't on, you were saying you were on at 11. Were you on live?
We were on live, yeah.
For your pilot episode?
Yeah, we used to have to wait for, wasn't Peter Hitchener. Whoever it was doing the late news, we had to basically wait for. And sometimes they would run long and so sometimes we wouldn't be on until 11:30, but we would be live.
So you were going once a week?
Once a week on a Wednesday, I think.
And it no brief?
No real brief, no. Like there was a guest, there was a couch. Me and Dave Callan would do these silly kind of doctor sketches where like we would be in the studio with a table and he'd wear a white lab coat and I would kind of come in and one of them was that I couldn't get a song out of my head and you know what you know
you need to do that for Carrie Bickmore. She's got, what's the song she's got stuck
unskinny,
in her head?
Unskinny bop. Cannot get it out of her head. I mean, there were songs to have in your head, I guess, but it was just such an amazing experience. And we did the pilot earlier that year and then like we did the series later that year and then they let us go. They wanted to keep Rove, and Rove, to his undying credit, my career is based on a lot of what happened with Rove. He was offered like $1 million to stay. He's a 23-year-old, but to cast everybody else adrift. And he was fearful of being warehoused, but also he knew, I think he had a good thing, he had a good team, and has said no without the promise of anything. He wasn't walking away going, Channel 10 will pick this up. That was not on the cards. So we waited quite a while. It was maybe not a year, but it was like 6-7 months. Where I remember just checking in with him, what's anything going on? We'd meet up, have a coffee, have a beer. And
so was he trying to sell the concept to somebody else?
Yeah,
then?
I mean, he could probably, you know, give you more detail than I could, but he was, you know, and I wouldn't try to harass him, but, you know, and he would let me know how things were going. And my manager, we had the same manager, so he would kind of, you know, kind of let me know. But it was like, why did you walk away, man?
Yeah. But I guess in that situation, as the person who is sort of the beneficiary of his benevolence, it can feel like, you know, he's done you a huge favor, which obviously going on in your career, that is absolutely true. But I think from an individual's perspective, if you are the most desired piece of the puzzle at that point in time, some people just want the money and run. But for some people, it seems like the lion's share of the enjoyment would have been from what you guys were creating together.
I think so. And I think with Rove, the last thing he wanted to do was be put into a game show that he didn't want to do. And that was the stage where people were paid good money to not do a lot.
Mm.
And that's, Rove had no interest in that.
Mm.
With that said, $1 million at 23, that's incredible.
Amazing.
You know, so... and he often say this, you know, he enjoyed my segment. I'd go to the desk and he could almost clock off and just enjoy. He could almost watch,
yeah,
you know. But we had a great chemistry and he was the most generous person on air. Like he, there would be times when a joke would be this in, you know, like in the air between us. We could both see it and he always let me go for it, which is so uncommon.
That is so nice because it is so uncommon. But I think when you work with people where you feel genuinely supported and cared for and working in that kind of environment where you're sitting down where all you want is for Rove to succeed in that situation. So you create an environment where nobody can fail because everybody's rooting for the other bloke.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I don't care who has that last line. Mm. If I'm on stage... or if I am, you know, on an ensemble, on the project, we're a team.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as the team's winning,
mm-hmm.
and if it means that Waleed has a funny line to break, then that's absolutely fine. If there have been times where I'm like, I've got this joke and I'm waiting to get it out, and I'm waiting to get it out. I think it happened last night, and well, I think it was Waleed. He had this joke and the audience loved it.
Yeah.
I was like, well, that's enough.
That'll do.
That's
enough.
You know, I will die with that joke in my head. You know?
And just stick another pin into the Waleed voodoo doll. so what the then was there a you were saying there was a bit of a gap before Channel 10 picked it up. Was that phone call like, phew?
I think we were kind of like, surely.
Yeah, you knew it worked.
Somebody. I mean, look at Rove. Like, surely somebody's going to give him a shot.
Mm.
And Channel 10, thankfully, didn't. Yeah, the call was, it was great. And we were so excited. And then it was tempered a little bit by... you know, it's going to be a different show. And so we didn't know what that meant initially. Because we were like really proud of the Channel 9 show. And I encourage anyone to look, you know, to look it up. It is on DVD. You know, you probably get it very cheaply. But it was a different kind of show. Like, I can't think of another show like it on Australian TV. Like, it's just...
it's stuff you couldn't get away with now.
No way.
Yeah.
Like, we couldn't, even if we were at 8:30 on Channel 9, we probably wouldn't get away with it.
Yeah.
You know? So it was just... write whatever you want and people will make it happen. And it was utterly glorious. But with that said, when we went to Channel 10, this show got bigger and it was, we still had a lot of fun and did a lot of, you know, kind of weird stuff as well. But, you know, it was a fun time. Like I said, Rove was as fun and as generous as you could hope for.
Did your life change significantly once that show kicked off?
Yeah, it did.
How'd you go with that?
I had moments. I remember, I don't think I've ever told anyone this, people who were there. No, I remember a lot of people coming up to me at Flemington Racecourse and being like really way too excited. At the end of the day, people were a bit pissed.
Mm.
And I actually like just burst into tears.
Yeah.
This is scary.
It's terrifying to go from never having experienced that to, because it's completely unnatural.
Yeah. And I'm not somebody who... you know, this may come as a shock, Rachel. I don't walk down Chapel Street kind of with a strut, with a bit of a look at me kind of posture. You know, like I don't like, and I still don't like it. Hughesy, who I love and is a great mate, he only half jokes that he doesn't wear sunglasses because he wants people to recognise him.
Yeah, right.
You know, he's very comfortable with that. I'm not saying if you're listening, don't ever approach me at all. Like, you know, if you're friendly and you're not, but some not yelling is always nice. The fame element was never a thing. I loved stand-up comedy. I loved the idea of making movies, you know, and that's where people make that argument about, well, and I don't get papped at all. So this is not coming with my own agenda. But when people say, well, you signed up for it. Mm. So, no, you didn't sign up for that. You signed up because you wanted to make people laugh or you wanted to be a journalist or, you know, whatever it was.
You're really lucky to not get papped because your profile is big, I've said this a number of times on the podcast, but I really think that is the holy grail, to be able to do what you love and to be able to go about your business.
Yeah, I heard you speak about to Loz Lawrence about it, and I'm very lucky. I mean, I'm not, like I said, I'm not. I work with Carrie, who is.
Because she sneezes and there's a story about
it. It's ridiculous. Yeah. And I see she handles it very well, but, you know, I know, you know, it can get to her as it would.
Of course.
It's ridiculous with some of the stuff she
has to go
through.
Because the thing about that, and I've spoken to a number of people about this, is that you get to a point where they feel like they need to second guess what they're saying. And I think everybody who's made it to a certain point, and Carrie is a great example of this, you know, people like her because she is so her. You know, you feel like you're getting the exact, there's no filter between the head and the brain, and what she's happy to be open, honest about who she is, what she's experienced, all of that kind of stuff. And I think that's what resonates with viewers, with listeners. But as soon as you start to, you know, really feel the pain of the news media dissecting everything you do, which is unavoidable because we are all human beings, you cannot have that much attention thrown on you and not start to think, oh goodness, is it me? Should I adjust? Then all of a sudden you start to take away all of those wonderful elements of you that make you so attractive to viewers and things.
And I'm sorry, she's already giving enough.
Yes,
what more do you want? Yeah. Like, really? Like, there was an article that she wrote, and it was about board games, and the headline on it was, when people play board games, people change, or something like that. It was quite a representative of the article. But then it goes to online. And the headline online became the thing that's tearing Carrie's family apart.
Oh, God.
Like, that's...
It's such a stretch.
Considering, like, the pressure, that's not fair.
No.
It's not fair on somebody.
And especially because it is quite amazing how few people read the article and how, like, they read the headline. They put all of their opinions and their attitude and their responses on Twitter into that headline, and they read nothing of what goes below it. And a mere paragraph will make you realize, oh, God, that headline had nothing to do with that. But we're in the clickbait culture, and nobody's going to click on it, Carrie plays board games.
No. Exactly right. So maybe it's not worth putting on your online. You know, like
exactly.
So, you know, it's hard not to become a little bit protective, you know, when you sitting next to this woman who has to go through this, and Waleed as well, who there's an uglier side to what he has to put up with. No, I'm very, very fortunate, and to be honest, with the Gold Logie nom, I was a bit kind of like, I'm not sure if I want this because I don't want to. Like, I'm comfortable with where I am. My thing has kind of been going under the radar a little bit. Still working. You know, I've been employed now. Well, I started 21 years ago, 99. So, 18 years. Mm. I think I had 1 year where I was kind of like this floating about between then. So, I've been very lucky, but I've floated under the radar.
I think that's the best place to be. So, over the time, you've done just about everything, the producing, directing, the writing, the stand-up, the radio, TV. Is there any one thing that you think, this is what I want to grow old doing?
I've fallen in love, and I'm not just saying this because you didn't mention it, but the thing that I've recently discovered and I'm falling in love with is I wrote a kid's book.
Oh, it was so good.
And yeah, but you read it. Yeah. But you see, you got in touch with me about that. That was nice. And that's not why I love the podcast either.
I felt like you felt, oh, God, I better give the podcast a listen. Oh, God.
So I wrote a kid's book and have fallen in love with the industry and the feeling that comes back at you when you put something like that out there into the world. You know, it went really well. It's still going really well. It's got Frankie Fish in the Sonic Suitcase.
It's great.
And I just like seeing people, you know, having people send you photos of their kids reading it, and the kids will write reviews, and it's usually they give you like 4.5 out of 5 stars or 9.5 out of 5 stars. I always leave half a star off, just, you know, just to keep you honest. And going to the schools and doing readings, it's kind of magical. And it's a 3-book deal. We're already talking about extending that and also maybe doing some other picture books. And I love it. And still not ready to give away my project share yet. Sorry, Tommy Little, I know you want it. but and you know, continue doing stand-up. I want to make that film. The dream has always been for me and my wife that we can go to Europe and kind of, you know, do the whole stay on a vineyard and write.
Yeah. What a magical dream. Yeah. And also just, you know, for all we've been speaking about, you know, the media and how harsh they can be. And quite often when you're offering your opinion, you're not 100% sure how it's going to be taken. And there are a whole bunch of issues and individuals that can see something that you say and turn it around and tweet it at you. When you are dealing with kids, and you're sitting down and reading them a great story, or you write them a book, you got none of that. Yeah. You've just got genuine joy, kids that just want to read and be lost in a story, who aren't influenced by all of that ickiness that we get when we get into adulthood. And it's just magic.
And you're putting something really, it's completely positive. You know, it's positive. It's got good messaging without being labored. And to see when I gave it to my 8-year-old, and I was reading to him, you know, as I was writing it, but to see him with the book, to see the pride, we look at our kids with pride, but to see the pride coming back was really special.
What do you think is the best and the worst part about the business?
The best part is we get to do it and create. Like, I've always loved the idea, like seeing a piece of paper as a kid. I was the kid who would be in my room writing, drawing, coming up with short stories, doing extra creative essays that I didn't need to do because I'd do 3 in the hand in the one that I like the most.
Wow.
You know, I would write lyrics to songs. I had a fake bands that would write a song album list. Like,
wow.
Yeah, there's one called the Jacobins, which were like the first political party in France.
Yeah.
And that was my band name. That was my band name. And yeah. I would have, you know, and one project that I, you know, kind of had this kind of thing of doing, dream of doing, was where I try to write lyrics and like team up with musicians to see, you know, and I was thinking maybe I should get other comedians to do, like, write a song each, but it can't be ironic, and it can't be kind of whimsy. It has to be like genuinely heartfelt, and like team people up with different musicians and kind of see what they can produce. I did hear Kate Langbrook did one with Casey Chambers on Nova years ago, and it was really lovely.
Yeah.
And I must say, I'd already had the idea, but I thought, well, that's a good example of, like, that's a textbook example of what this idea was about.
Did your parents know you were going to do this, being that kind of kid?
I think so, yeah. They always, and even like friends of the family, Pete's always got a pen and paper in his hand, he's always got a notebook, and I've got notebooks kind of everywhere. I still love, if I go to an airport, I have to buy a notebook and a pen. And I go to the airport a lot. So it's just like, there's nothing more exciting than a blank sheet of paper.
I love hearing the stories, doing this podcast, hearing the stories and just seeing there is a similarity between the people that have made it in this business in a creative way, and it is that sort of obsessive production, that sort of I need to make this stuff. Even when I was little, I needed to make stuff just because.
And that's the thing, and everybody's kind of thinking, oh, it'd be great to be famous. I mean, the idea of fame occurs to you at some point. I remember sitting on trains going, one day I'm going to be the most famous person on this train. If these people like meet in 30 years, I'll be the one they'll want to come up to and say hello to. You know, I remember having that thought. But with that said, it was always about the creative and producing stuff.
Yeah, I used to interview myself on the toilet. Yeah, I used to pretend I was in a talk show interviewing myself about my life and stuff, and I'd always do it on the toilet.
You should pitch that, you know. Maybe you could have, like, instead of, like, you know, you have like a guest, so it's not you interviewing you, but you have a bidet in there as well. So your guest comes in on the bidet.
It's like a slightly less family friendly version of comedians in cars getting coffee. You know, it's like
comedians cleaning their ass
after coffee. Right, we're down to the final 5 questions. Your biggest regret over the years?
My biggest regret. I gotta say, I don't have too many of them. There was a show on Channel 7, which is, I guess, my one misfire on TV, called The Bounce, which is an AFL show. And I don't actually have regret. I just regret that it didn't work. But at the same time, if that didn't work, then I don't get to be on the project. You know, I heard Larry kind of speak about, you need to have failures. And I've been very lucky. You know, Rove Live, Skid House ran for 3 seasons. Before the Game ran for 12. It's a Date had a very successful 2 seasons, which is what we kind of were happy to do. The project now, I'm 4 years into that on a show that's been around for seven, 8 years. So I've been very lucky. Mm. The Bounce, I think, was a show that started off really well as an AFL-based show. I'd already created another one called Before the Game. And I thought, imagine if I could create 2 AFL shows. That would be amazing. And I wasn't really doing anything when they rang and asked if I wanted to be involved. So I was like, yep. And I'm really proud of it. There's some sketches we did on that show that I think some of the best. There's one about a guy who painted his face yellow and brown for the Hawthorn Premiership Grand Final. And then he used the wrong paint and he couldn't get the paint off. So then he has to live with this. On his wedding day, we had wedding shots of him. You know, his kids are scared of him. And, you know, it's one of my favorite sketches I've ever written. So I'm really proud about that show. We had a really good first 2 weeks, not a bad third. And then MasterChef started on Channel 10, where I work now, and was the juggernaut that wiped us off. And 7 don't have the patience that 10 do. And then they just went, okay, it's time now.
What's your dream gig? I assume it might be writing books in a vineyard.
That's probably it. I was actually thinking, I'm not sure. There's lots of ideas that I have, and I do want to get that one we've kind of cryptically spoken about going. But I think this guy way and write, and I just want to produce stuff. When I say not as necessarily the producer, although that you tend to be the producer if you do kind of create it, but I just want to kind of get stuff made.
Mm.
And I can see eventually, you know, I'll be off screen. And I had 1 year off screen, which was quite interesting. What I've found about that, I was relieved because I was okay with it, which was really nice. It's the first time in, like, at that stage, 12 years or whatever, that I'm not on screen. And it's like, this is okay, this is good.
It's a great place.
So at some point, I think I'll probably say, okay, I don't need to be on screen anymore. I'll work at writing the books and trying to help other people get stuff made.
Mm. Well, I'm going to assume that the big idea that you haven't got up is actually the one that we're not going to talk about, but that Watch This Space will.
Watch This Space, yeah.
If you weren't doing this, what would you be doing?
That's the scariest question. I'd be a heckler. Maybe a sports journo.
Oh, yeah, because you love your sport, don't you? You're always watching, you and Waleed are always watching, like, getting excited over replays of goals and things. I'm like, well, how can, I mean, I couldn't watch it the first time, but you already know what happened.
Yeah, I'm a very passionate Collingwood fan. And
actually, my boyfriend will kill me if I do not say at least once, Strawny.
Yeah, actually, one of the regrets, actually, we wrote a Strawny movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and, like, you know, there was a production company assigned and wrote a script, and I loved the script. Like, it was funny, and it just kind of went away. I think we kind of thought, these things take a lot, you know, of energy to put a movie out there. Is there the market to do it, really? As much as big as AFL is, there's no international possibilities for this. North of the border.
People here would love it.
Yeah, and I thought it was really funny. It was about Strawny. He stole the 2010 Premiership Cup, and then he was arrested for it. And the only person he would speak to was Mike Sheehan, the doyen of journalists. And he does a segment called Open Mic. So he ended up being based around this open mic session in jail with Mike Sheehan and Strawny. And the rest
that's cool.
Tortured flashbacks and stuff like that. It was really cool.
Oh, you have to do that.
Yeah, and we're going to have, like, I think, you know, Luke McGregor was going to be his, like, cousin. And, like, Ronnie Cheng was going to be his cousin. And, like, Luke McGregor was going to be his manager, and, you know, it was, those guys were, you know, just babies, you know.
Yeah.
Then that was the idea. It just kind of weirdly, it wasn't like, I think both me and the production company just went, oh, I'm not sure if either had the absolute passion.
Yeah, and you got
to
wait.
To get anything, to get, like, a movie particularly made, you got to have so much passion for it.
Yeah,
like,
definitely.
Bruce Springsteen said something amazing, you know, heard recently, which is, yeah, ambition has to outweigh your fear. You need to really want it.
Mm. Yeah. And there has to be sort of no other path that you can see apart from that getting made. You know, you have to go, yes, this is, I know it's going to be hard, but I just cannot not have this made right now. And until you feel that.
Eventually it blinds you. Like, you become like, you get tunnel vision about a project. And that's when you feel like, okay, this is the one. It's time to press go.
And finally, your advice to people wanting to get into the business.
As Lauren said, just do it and get on stage as much as you can. Flying hours are the most important thing. And ideas, I'll just repeat what Rosso told me. Ideas is the best advice I've been given. Ideas are king. They're more important than punchlines. Try to be good at punchlines as well, but if you're a comedian. But no, ideas. don't let anyone ask you if do you have an idea for something and not have an answer.
And if you ask an audience where they're from, have something to say.
Just if you're a comedian starting out, just
study the Melways.
Go easy on the audience participation.
Yeah, leave it to the professionals. Pete, right now we are sitting on opposite sides of the table, but I'm going to give you the biggest squeezy hug when we are done because I really appreciate your time. It was awesome having you on the show.
I'll squeeze back. It'll all be appropriate and above board, but I will. No, thank you. Congratulations. I think it's a great thing that you're doing. There's not enough. It's hard because people do often ask me how I got into television. How do you get into television? And I feel like there are so many different doors that you can actually enter from. And I feel like I entered from, you know, through stand-up comedy, and that's not necessarily the right way for everyone. So do whatever you can, like watch as much, read as much, meet as many people as you can. And, you know, you need a little bit of luck along the way. You need a few champions. I had some champions, a few we've already mentioned, and want to do it for the right reasons.
And I think you've given sort of teenagers everywhere a great excuse when their parents tell them to get away from the television. Research, Mum.
Research, Peter Hellyer said.
Thanks, Pete.
Thanks, Rach.
Thanks for listening to You've Got to Start Somewhere.
Thanks.
To subscribe to the podcast, check out other episodes, and keep up to date, head to youvegottostartsomewhere.com.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of the podcast, and a big thank you if you are one of the delightful humans who has sent me an email or a tweet or left a review in iTunes to say that you are enjoying the show. Big shout out to Mike Boyd and Philo who have recently left reviews. I really appreciate the feedback and I'm so chuffed that you're loving the chats just as much as I am loving to do them. Next week, I am so excited about Lee Sales, the host of 7:30 on the ABC. She is going to be joining me for a chat. I have been a huge fan of her work for a long time. We're going to be sitting down and talking about what has been a very successful career and the path she took to hosting the ABC's flagship current affairs program. Usually in this section of the show, I drop a bit of audio from the upcoming episode as a little teaser, but we did reference something in this episode that I wanted to play here, and that is the sketch that Merrick Watts and Peter Hellyer did on the show that I used to do with Merrick and Jules on Triple M, where they reenacted their very first shift on Plenty Valley FM. It is hilarious. I have dived deep into my archives to find it, and I thought, what better way to finish up a great chat with a great man than this? I'll see you next week.
That was a new artist called Lenny Kravitz with his song, Are You Going to Go My Way? You're on Plenty Valley FM with Merrick and Peter. And the time is a bit after lunch.
Hey, Mez, remember?
It's 1:25.
Okay, sorry. Good to get that right. Mez, you remember when we were back at high school?
Yeah, it was just a few weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah. Remember how when the emergency teacher left the room and, like, you'd play a trick on them?
Yeah, I sure do. Classic.
Classic.
Later on in the show, our friend James is coming in.
Is he? Hey, Mez, when you were a kid and you got a BMX out of flat tire and you had to push it home and your friends would laugh at you, do you remember that?
Yeah.
Classic.
I never had a puncture. Pete, you've got an ad to read.
Oh, sure do, Mez. Press the CDs.
Yep.
Some music.
Hang on. Hang on.
Press it. It's the one on the left.
Hang on. Okay.
Okay. If you're looking for garden supplies, then there's only one place in the Diamond Valley you should go to. Sorry, it's in a page.
Yes, they've printed on the other side.
Oh. Where was I? I've read this before. Valley Supplies on Bond Street, they're really good.
You reckon? My dad reckons this shit. But a little bit later on the show, we've got some more really good music. I've got a new song from Nirvana, "Rape Me."
That's, oh, we went. No, they the management said we can't play that song anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we got to play the Hootie and the Blowfish.
I've only got two CDs. I only brought two CDs in.
You were supposed to.
I don't have a lot of CDs.
Are they mixed ones? Did you bring Summer Breaks 83, Throbbing 84?
No.
You bring those ones in because they're the ones that have the. All the different songs. You can't just bring playing Nirvana all the time.
Time is, it's about three or four minutes after.
And it's 27 degrees.
School fast.
Oh, that's in Sydney.
This weekend, the school fight's on.
Are you going, Mez?
No, I'm too old for that.
Me too. Rape me again.